on this edition for Sunday, May 10th. The economic impacts of the coronavirus crisis, the future of hospital design shaped by a pandemic, and little free libraries going beyond books to help those in need. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
Consumer Cellular offers no-contract wireless plans that are designed to help you do more of the things you enjoy. Whether you're a talker, texter, browser, photographer, or a bit of everything, our U.S.-based customer service team is here to find a plan that fits you. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us. The month of May in the United States is usually a time for spring celebrations and gatherings of families and friends, from Mother's Day today to school graduations and Memorial Day picnics and parades. This year, many people are celebrating virtually with the hope that the coronavirus does not resurge. But there are gatherings today, in some churches, at homes, and in restaurants and parks where restrictions are easing. Let's get started with today's top news. As most states begin reopening after weeks of shutdowns, Trump administration officials warned today that the unemployment rate is likely to continue to rise.
The reported numbers are probably going to get worse before they get better, but that's why we're focused on rebuilding this economy.
More than 3 million people applied for jobless benefits last week, bringing the total over the last 7 weeks to 33.5 million. Members of Congress say they are discussing new financial relief bills with the White House. Public health experts are cautioning that reopening too quickly without increased testing could cause another spike in COVID-19 cases, something state governors are monitoring.
Maybe we never get a vaccine. We're going to have to deal with, you know, hopefully a treatment that will come along that will be very effective. But even without that, everyone's going to have to wear a mask. We're still going to have to socially distance. The truth is that coronavirus is still out there. It hasn't gone anywhere.
Three members of the White House Coronavirus Task Force are now in self-imposed quarantines after contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Robert Redfield, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Dr. Stephen Hahn, commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, all said they are at, quote, low risk and have tested negative. In statements, the three officials said they will take necessary precautions if their essential work requires them to go to the White House. CDC guidelines include screenings, wearing face coverings, and social distancing. In a meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff yesterday, neither President Trump nor any of the military leaders present wore masks, but all sat a few feet apart. Around the world, there are now more than 4 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins University. But as the rate of new infections slow, countries continue to plan for what comes next. In a speech today, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson laid out a plan for how the UK will slowly start easing the lockdown it has been under since March 23rd. Johnson outlined a 5-stage virus alert system, with each stage allowing more aspects of the economy and daily life to restart.
Throughout this period of the next 2 months, we will be driven not by mere hope or economic necessity. We're going to be driven by the science, the data, and public health.
The UK has reported more than 31,000 coronavirus-related deaths, the second highest death toll in the world behind only the United States. In China, health officials reported today that a city in the northeast part of the country had nearly a dozen new coronavirus cases. It's a reminder of the challenge of controlling the pandemic, even in places where the virus was thought to be under control. India has issued new guidelines for the reopening of factories as the country begins to ease restrictions in some regions during its COVID-19 lockdown. The plan includes cleaning of work areas every 2 to 3 hours, employee temperature checks twice a day, the use of face shields and masks, and the addition of barriers for physical distancing. The move comes days after at least 11 people were killed by a gas leak at a factory making polystyrene products was allowed to reopen. Authorities are still investigating the cause of the accident. Iran says it has offered to do a prisoner swap with the United States with no conditions because of the coronavirus outbreak. Both Iran and the United States have called for the release of prisoners because of the risk the virus poses. An Iranian spokesperson said today that the U.S. has yet to respond to its offer. One likely candidate for the swap is U.S. Navy veteran Michael White, who has been detained in Iran since 2018. In mid-March, White was released from prison on medical furlough because of the risk of coronavirus, but is required to stay in Iran. With most high school graduation ceremonies canceled this month, Student Reporting Labs is collecting video diaries of high school students across the country on social media. To learn where to submit your hashtag senior portrait, go to studentreportinglabs.org. As COVID-19 cases surged in March and April, there was a scramble to secure protective equipment for healthcare workers on the front lines. But what about changes to the medical spaces themselves to protect both workers and patients? NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has a look at one hospital retrofitting its spaces to fight the virus.
On the afternoon of April 15, 2013, two pressure cooker bombs detonated near the finish line of the Boston Marathon, killing three and injuring hundreds. Within minutes, the hospitals in the area were flooded with patients and quickly responded.
The hypotheticals were the 9/11 type of hypothetical, the Boston Marathon disaster, you know, that tragedy in which there was a huge influx of critically ill people that were going to come in. You know, that is absolutely in place.
According to Dr. John Bukovalis of Mount Sinai Hospital, trauma centers prepare for these mass casualty events. What isn't in place are plans for how hospitals need to physically change to respond to what the globe is facing now, the outbreak of an airborne pandemic disease.
One of the big takeaways is that our medical system is not designed to manage a surge of a pandemic of this nature. And that should kind of awaken all of us to the challenges we have of our healthcare infrastructure, full stop.
Michael Murphy is the executive director of the socially minded architecture and design collective, Mass Design Group.
Our hospitals are designed, you know, with very tight margins to fill beds and have them largely full all the time. They're not designed to have excess of beds. And what that means during this outbreak and surge is that the system itself has been pushed to its limits.
At Dr. Bukovalis Hospital in New York, the medical center was forced to rapidly transition traditional care spaces to wards exclusively for COVID-19 patients.
Even at baseline, the clinical world has not thought very deliberately about the built environment.
As the pandemic grew, the hospital brought in Dr. Neil Shah of the Global Health Innovation Center, Ariadne Labs, as well as architect Michael Murphy to study how a hospital redesign could keep patients and health workers safe.
Basically, every delivery system in the country and in the world had to adapt on the fly. And New York City at Mount Sinai Hospital was literal ground zero for this global pandemic for a couple weeks. And it was just an extraordinary opportunity to try to figure out how we not only learn what Mount Sinai is doing, but create lessons for the rest of the world very quickly.
Over a 3-week period in early April, Mount Sinai used remote observers to examine the various spatial changes the hospital implemented. Using GoPro cameras, doctors walked through the medical units to give the outside clinicians and designers a sense of the infection control designs.
We took video, we interviewed people, and they could then peer in. And that allowed us to make the observations incredibly quickly.
What were some of those key data points that you learned from this study as it relates to the design of the hospital?
Infection control protocols usually are used to protect patients. In this situation, we have to protect everyone, providers, the people that did environmental services, the people that were moving in and out of the clerks and things like that. So there's a lot of administrative support staff. So it's a whole different mindset.
The shift in mindset meant making strategic decisions that could work within the structure of decades-old buildings. IV machines that typically sit inside a patient's room were moved out into hallways to minimize medical staff interacting with infected patients. For contagious diseases like COVID-19, the standard of care is negative pressure isolation rooms, but hospitals typically don't have very many. During the surge of COVID-19 patients, Mount Sinai converted 260 regular rooms to specialized negative pressure isolation rooms.
We're also able to see where clinicians were also putting tape on the floor, putting up visual cues to try to articulate to staff when they were walking into a red zone, a contaminated zone, when they were leaving that zone, so that we could be more cognizant of the amount of PPE that we were wearing. And those simple spatial markers are really essential nudges that could allow us to remind ourselves, hey, we're entering a more dangerous zone, be more protected.
Mass Design Group has worked in the middle of epidemics in the past. In 2015, it designed a hospital to help fight the cholera outbreak in Haiti. And during the 2014 Ebola crisis in West Africa, the firm developed a set of national standards for health infrastructure design in Liberia. Murphy says these experiences influence the way he thinks about physical space and how it impacts health. What changes have been made since your study?
I would say one of the fundamental things that's changed is not just for hospitals, but for all of us, is this incredible spatial awareness. Are we going to be contaminated by leaving our house? Are we going to contaminate others? And that incredible spatial cognition that the spaces around us are potentially infectious or potentially healthier is a significant paradigm shift in the way we think about the world around us, I think, and should and will shape the way we design hospitals a little bit more deliberately in the future. And how we can design for trust are going to be crucial for every one of our public spaces.
When the coronavirus emerged in the U.S., people who share books on a small scale and countless others who wanted to help their neighbors saw a new need. Boxes and stands offering free household goods, food, and other supplies appeared with signs saying, "Take what you need." Now, there's a growing network of sharing boxes nationwide, and many began as part of the nonprofit organization Little Free Library. Part of the routine for the Hillman family in Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, is a daily walk and a visit to the little free library they added to their front yard last summer.
So this is our little library.
We'd never heard of these until we moved to Wisconsin about 6 years ago. And a lot of neighborhoods that we'd been walking through and had seen around town would occasionally have a little free library, and we were curious about what they were.
Once we discovered what little free libraries were, we were utilizing them. So I guess part of it is just for our own selfish needs to have an exchange of books.
The Hillman's Library is one of more than 100,000 of these book-sharing boxes installed around the world since the movement began in 2009. After the first few weeks of Wisconsin's coronavirus stay-at-home order, the family wanted to be sure their little library box was still safe and meeting the town's new needs.
We had books in the library, and we just put a few cans of food in the library, and then we noticed they were gone. So we thought, well, maybe there is a need here in our community.
They weren't alone. Many stewards, all volunteers, began transforming their little free libraries. Greg Metzer, the executive director of Little Free Library, first saw pantry items appear on the organization's social media feeds.
The Little Free Library Network gives the physical opportunity for people to connect, right, and support each other as a community, even though they're not necessarily connecting physically, you know, right next to one another. So it's been great to see this unfold.
The organization issued new guidelines on cleaning the little libraries as stewards began offering everything from hard-to-find toilet paper to toys like Play-Doh and all kinds of foods. In El Cajon, California, Alice Baker is maintaining her little free library.
So every day I try to come out and scrub it down and sanitize it and then spray it down with Lysol.
With libraries and schools closed, Baker sees an even bigger need to keep books on her shelves along with household goods. On Staten Island in New York, Heather Butts is also keeping books on hand.
So there are a new supply of books to the extent that the young people and everybody that goes to these little free libraries and can avail themselves of books. It's critical, and I think it brings a sense of normalcy, a sense of security, I certainly hope, and a sense of stability to people that is warm and gratifying.
To help connect people in need to these new sharing boxes, Little Free Library built an interactive map in April. More than 300 locations were added in the first few weeks, evidence that the little libraries may continue serving as food pantries well into the future.
I think that COVID-19 has shown us that a lot of people were in a precarious situation prior to COVID-19. And now that they're in COVID-19, it's sort of tipped the scale, unfortunately, for a lot of people into a truly crisis arena. And that's not going to tip back immediately once the pandemic is over.
In Wisconsin, the Hillmans say they don't know who is coming and going from their little pantry, but a surprise overnight restocking shows they're not alone in their desire to help others.
The next day when we were walking by, the library was full again. And it was just, it was really touching because I think it showed us the community that we do live in that, you know, we as the stewards of the Little Free Library thought we would be the ones maintaining the what is now the food pantry, but we're not. Our neighbors in our community are also doing that with us, which is just has just been really remarkable to see.
Before the COVID-19 pandemic, deportations of undocumented immigrants and the policies surrounding the process were a regular part of news coverage. During the current crisis, news about deportations and immigration, like many other issues, has not been as prominent. But one man's recent removal from the United States caught the attention of his own community and beyond. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Tom Cachado has our story.
Peekskill, New York sits on the eastern bank of the Hudson River, a former factory town, now more a haven for artists. It's about an hour's commute from New York City. Among its many charms, it's a great place to see wintering bald eagles. These shots belong to a notable local photographer who shared them on a popular Facebook page. His name is Hazzah Alomasi. He's known by his nickname, Anwar.
My girlfriend and I were here photographing eagles, and I have a professional camera that I have no idea how to use. And he noticed, and he came over and he showed me how to use it, and which setting to have, which lens to put on. He was very, very nice.
He was just like that. He was a lovable person and very caring, very considerate of others.
I first met Anwar. He was working at a local gas station.
Most people don't make friends with their gas station attendant.
This gathering of Alomasi's friends in the bird-loving community took place shortly before New York's governor ordered the end of social gatherings. They came together to talk about him because suddenly he was gone. He had spent 22 years in the United States, living, working, and paying taxes, they said. The fact that he had never become a citizen wasn't an issue.
Here I am, you know, a Jewish guy, okay? Pretty much born and raised in this area with a Muslim as now one of my closest friends.
Andy Starr is a sales and marketing consultant and wildlife photographer who often went out taking pictures with Alomasi. Starr accompanied his friend to a visit with his immigration officer last fall. Alomasi had been checking in regularly with immigration since 2011.
I saw a ledger that he had to sign on a regular basis with immigration. Every 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, he would have to go down to Federal Plaza, meet with his caseworker and sign in. He went to sign in and his caseworker told him to come back in 30 days. And he thought that was unusual. So he was thinking something's up.
Something was up. In January, another friend of Alomasi's, the mayor of Peekskill, Andre Rainey, received an unexpected phone call.
And he was just saying, hey, you know, Andre, I need your help, man. I'm in a correctional facility in New Jersey, and ICE picked me up. ICE picked you up for what? Like, what are they picking you up for? And then I got the call Tuesday, the next day, that Anwar was gone.
Alomasi was deported in late January to his native Yemen. It's a country in the midst of a civil war.
Even the animals here in Yemen are paying the price. Even the animals here are paying the price. It's the war, and it's very sad.
Do you hope to return now to the United States?
Yes, it is like a dream. It's like going to heaven. It's like you're going from hell to heaven.
In the States, he had been active protesting human rights abuses in Yemen. He says that makes him a target now, and his life is in danger.
I have to hide, and I thank God my uncles has friends over here. They can take me every morning from one place to another place, and I stay in the taxi, the car has tint.
He reminisced about his life in New York, taking pictures with his friends.
And both eagles, my favorite birds, and I love them so much, and I spend all day in the river, in the cold water, just waiting to get them. The way they fly, it just, you know, I spend almost from sunrise to sunset, I even get tired of them.
Alamacy is one of at least 3.7 million persons deported during the Obama and Trump administrations. No doubt he's not the first of them to love America, but he may be the most accomplished at documenting its national symbol.
How ironic. Take a picture of the bald eagle, the American symbol. It's just...
He was not a citizen of the United States, but he resided here.
Paperwork may not say so, but we consider him a citizen. Paperwork doesn't always say everything.
Anwar Alamacy's deportation drew national attention when it occurred. Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer even took up his case on Twitter. Then came COVID-19 and social distancing. Stories like Alamacy's are out of the news now, though not out of the hearts of those who miss him.
It's hard. Just the fact that he's in danger. His life is in danger every day. And knowing that there's nothing that you can do. I messaged him yesterday and asked him if he wanted me to mention anything on his behalf. And he just said that he wants to come home as soon as possible.
We have more on Alamacy's story as well as politics with Jeff Greenfield and a profile of versatile artist Kate Tempest at pbs.org/newshour. Across the country, this Mother's Day is perhaps being celebrated in ways never done before. Back in March, Christina Lewis Halperin shared her experience about giving birth to her third child in New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Carla Murthy checked back in to see how she's doing this Mother's Day with her new daughter.
When we last spoke, Macy was 2 days old.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Well, Macy is 6 weeks and 3 days old. And she's grown a ton. She's great. Things have been good overall.
I've heard that a lot of new parents have been reluctant to bring their babies in to see the doctors for checkups. What has that experience been like for you?
We took Macy to the doctor. We were just very careful that we have to trust that they know what they're doing. All the doctors now have new protocols. I didn't even touch anything. I didn't open a door. They did a survey electronically, so I didn't have to touch paper or their pens. I suppose I did have to hand over my credit card, but it was nearly contactless. But we did do telemedicine. She had a rash. So we called our doctor in the city, and I held her up to the screen, and he told us what to do, and yeah, the rash went away.
How has the idea of motherhood changed now, now that we're in this pandemic?
Yeah, it's Mother's Day, and I've been thinking about that and being a parent and what it means now. So it's always been my job to keep them physically and emotionally safe, right? But now that's become both a lot harder, but also in a way a lot clearer. There's CDC guidance saying what you're supposed to do and what you need to do to keep everyone safe. And that's what we do. And there isn't any arguing about it. Get that mask on.
She has no idea the world that she was just brought into.
No, she's lived her entire life in lockdown. We talk about that all the time. I think it helps to think about one day this will be, this will be over. And what I'll tell my grandkids and what she'll tell her grandkids and what a story she'll have, right? Sometimes I wonder if my children and even us will turn into a new greatest generation I mean, I like to believe that from great struggles and this collective hardship come resilience.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Happy Mother's Day. Stay healthy.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.